Mr. John Arthur, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Arthur?
Yes. I was born on the 15th of October, 1920, at 12:38 in the morning. And I know that because I was a twin, and twins have their date of birth put on their birth certificate. I was born in Camberwell, in my parents' little house. My father was a schoolmaster. Mother had been a nurse in the army, and they married because they met in the army. They got married in 1918. This is their first little house they set up, and we were there for about 10 or 12 years. I went to the little church school. We had, I do remember, pot hooks and hangers, and we had chalk and squeaky, whatever it is that we, the slates that we squeaked on. Anyway, from there I went to grammar school, and I finished up in a grammar school in the East India Dock Road for some odd reason, although I lived in, by then I was living in Dulwich. But it was an interesting school. It was George Green, and he'd been a shipbuilder on the Isle of Dogs, and it had quite a naval connection. The local dockmaster's children were there, and it was quite an interesting place to be. I went through my various examinations. My father was...
Did you have any particular special, you know, subjects you liked?
Well, I had... Yes, that's an interesting one. My father taught chemistry, and I was reasonably bright at sciences, and he wanted me to do the career that he never had. He wanted me to get a scholarship to Oxford and get a degree at Oxford. And I could have done it. I would have done it, except I didn't have any Latin. You don't have Latin in grammar school. So... But my main interest was in art, in drawing, and I used to get the school prizes, and so on. I liked that more than anything else. But my father's opinion was that the only way that you would make money is on a pavement outside the National Gallery. So I was shoved along. I got my in those days we called higher school certificate, and I got in the sciences, and I was exempt from the first year of the university BSc. In fact, I could start in the second year. I had my inter-BSc at school. Now, I didn't particularly look forward to going into the university to study sciences. It was in 1939 when I passed my final examination. And before that, it was quite obvious there was a war coming along. It was very obvious indeed. Hitler was just across the water, and some people may have believed that there would be peace in their time, but not all of us.
What did you think? I mean, how much did you follow what was going on in Germany?
Very much. One of the reasons was this, because in the 30s there was an enormous depression. My father's salary was cut overnight by 10%, and so straight away he had to find other ways. And he took in German au pairs, and we got to know in the 1935, 36, 37, a number of these people from Germany. They were very pleasant young women. And then the source dried up, so we had our contacts in Germany, and we got warned by some of them, that things were changing rather rapidly. And we saw what was going on in Germany. Didn't like it. Hitler, it was very personal, as the Balkans isn't personal at the moment, and all these things are abstract, but Hitler was a threat to England, a direct threat. Now, I wanted to get in on the action. Now, my mother had been a nurse, and she'd gone into the Army Nursing Reserve, and she'd been off to France in August 1914 with the BEF, and she was, I suppose, if anything, a bit gung-ho, which my father was not. He'd been a boffin, and he'd been in the army, but he didn't like active service.
Who had he served with? Who had he served with, do you recall?
Oh, General Horrocks. He was, in fact, his job was water treatment. He used to take water out of ditches and feed it to the troops after processing it with his particular machine, which he got an OBE for, and he was all pleased about that. But he was not, in any sense, gung-ho. Mother was. Now, I took after mother, my brothers didn't. I was, two of my brothers didn't. But I wanted to get into action. I wanted to join the Navy. So I went aboard HMS President, and I was a bit scared because of all these chief gunners, mates and things padding around, which they were fairly, they always have been fairly scary people. But anyway, they put me on to the only avenue that they had open at the moment, which was the Fleet Air Arm. Now, they didn't have any ships, so they didn't need any officers. But they did have aircraft, which kept on getting shot down, so they needed plenty of young officers. They didn't put it like that. So I signed up. I remember going for an interview in Admiralty Arch itself, did a medical there, and I was accepted into the RNSR just before the war. The RNSR was Royal Naval Special Reserve and was concocted to cope with people like me who would normally have gone in as young officers, but because of everybody was equal, we had to go in as ratings.
Now, when exactly was this? Did this take place? That was what month?
July 1939.
And do you remember the interview at all, or any of the procedures you went through?
Not really. There was various people in plain clothes sitting around a table, and they asked me about my interests and my qualifications and so on and so on. But I rather think that, suppose you could speak the King's English and hadn't been told about being shot down, you're probably very welcome.
Had you an interest in flying or the Navy before?
No, the Navy, yes, not flying, but it seemed to me, why not, you know? I never thought about it, but it seemed as good a way as any.
What about your interest in the Navy? What did that come from?
I think probably because I knew a lot of, when I was at school, I knew a lot of people in the dockmaster's sons and children. There's a great merchant navy influence there on the Isle of Dogs. So, and it was me going to spend a year training in the RNSR to be an observer in the Fleet Air Arm in between school and university. That was the idea. But of course, when they finally called me up, I was accepted in July, but they finally called me up in September.
Now, do you remember the Declaration of War? That would come first, I presume.
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember of that?
Helping in the local village school to fit civilians with gas masks. Well, that was what the beginning of the war was, the issue of gas masks to everybody.
And how did you fit them?
Oh, just pushed it over their head and adjusted the tapes and got on with the next one.
Were they a standard size?
Absolutely. But the only thing adjusted was the tape. So,
What about the actual broadcast? Do you recall that?
Yes, I think I did. It was a bit chilling, in fact, because having been accepted for the service, and in my mind I was thinking, well, after a year I'll be off to university, I suddenly realised that I wouldn't be, and it was my life was going to be changed from that moment. No argument. And I accepted it. It was a great relief that, in fact, a decision had been made for me, because I wasn't particularly keen to go to university. Now, I went into the I went down to Gosport to HMS St Vincent, which had been a boys, what was still then a boys training establishment, and we'd taken over one small wing of it for the 40 or 50 of us who were training to be Fleet Air Arm. And we were all naval airmen second class. Our pay was 14 shillings a week, 2 shillings a day. And I remember whinging at the first week because I only got 10 bob. They didn't hand out silver, only notes.
Now, what was your reception when you got there? You know, how did they sort of take you from a callow youth arriving to
Well, they were all picked up at the station in a naval truck, taken into barracks the first night you spent in civilian clothes, and after that they took you and kitted you out, and after that you were a sailor. You looked like one, and you had very strange garments which you'd never worn before. You didn't have fly buttons, for example. You had a flap that let down in front and a couple of broad bands that went across the stomach, and the whole thing held up by a belt. You had a jumper and you had your collar, and you had to learn how to put all these things on, and it was quite an interesting... But we were helped. We had a number of petty officers, chief petty officers, have been brought back into the service after they'd retired, after they'd done their 20 years, whatever it is. So these are men in their middle, late 40s who came and guided us into the service because we were on a fast track. I remember one particularly, there was an old chief yeoman who served as a boy signaller, at the Battle of Jutland. So he took us away how you manoeuvre a battle fleet at sea by flag signals, which was fascinating. And you then felt, I felt then, I still feel it today, that the direct link in the Navy between Nelson, right through, and in those days, you still felt it was, to a large degree, Nelson's Navy. You still had the rum, if you were over 18, or over whatever it was, 21 perhaps. 21. But you still had that feeling that here was a chap who was at Jutland and sailing wasn't very far away. You had the victory in Portsmouth across the other side of the Gosport. And you felt that you were... I felt then, and I feel today, I was very privileged to be accepted into what was an extended family with a great history.
Now, what about the rest of the 50 or so, naval airmen, second class? What kind of lads were they? Were they the same sort of background as yourself, or was it varying?
It varied to a degree, but it basically was people, obviously the age of 18, 19, of certain educational standards. So they were grammar school, public school mixture. But they were officer material.
All of them?
They were chosen for that.
And how did you get on with them?
Reasonably well. It was a great shakedown because basically, you see, if you go to a day school, grammar school, you have very little contact with other youths of your age in different walks of life. And that was the first thing you learnt, that the diversity, attitude, education, the lot. But we were kept very busy. We started...
And can I just ask you about your accommodation?
The accommodation.
Was it barracks or huts?
HMS St Vincent is a brick frigate, so-called. It's a brick barracks of, I think, five blocks, A, B, C, D, F, G. We were in G block at the end. And it had one of those enormous great training masts with a net underneath it that you had to go up.
I'll come... What were the actual barracks like? Could you describe, the room you were
in? Yes, like any other naval barracks. They had a wooden floor, which you polished every day. They had mess tables, and you slept in hammocks. You were issued with a hammock, and you were told how to lash it and how to sling it.
And how did you take to hammocks?
Hammock is the most... A sailor's best friend, no question. It's a marvellous thing to sleep in. And you carry it around with you. I carried a hammock when I was, one occasion I was being drafted on the ferry to Northern Ireland, and I unlashed it and slung it up on the ferry before it went, and I was very comfortable. All the others were sort of shivering around, and I was warm and comfortable.
Was it something you had to get used to, or was it just straight away?
Straight away.
Never had a problem with it?
No problem at all.
And so, what about the washing facilities?
You had showers, and you had a common ablution block.
Now, in order to look at the train, if we look at a typical day, then we'll pick up the elements of the train.
Yes.
What sort of time would your day start?
You start at about 7:30, and you'd muster. You'd have before breakfast you'd have training in something like aerial navigation or something like that for half an hour. You'd have breakfast.
Would that be a lecture or a practical?
No, it'd be a lecture. It was very much in the form of classes being lectured by instructors, naval instructor.
And the lectures, could you follow them? I mean, aerial navigation.
Oh yes, absolutely. They were geared to people with what are called today A levels. So aerial navigation is something. It's an extension of trigonometry. And spherical trigonometry was something new to me, but you pick it up. It's no major problem. But so we all had that, and after breakfast we would fall in.
Hang on, breakfast. What about naval food? Your first experience of it. What did you think of the food?
Can't remember. We were just hungry, so we ate everything put in front of us. No complaints.
So, food not the sort of thing you remember or worry about.
No.
So after breakfast, what then?
You'd fall in for divisions, and after that you would have...
What were divisions? Sorry.
Divisions is when the whole of the ship's company falls in. It's a morning parade, and after divisions, anything that's read out, and you then march off the parade ground. It's a fairly formalised business. That is when the any ceremonial is carried out. We didn't have a band there, but it was a boys' training place, basically, so it was for them. But we'd go square bashing.
How did you take to drill?
I liked it better than I expected to.
Why had you expected not to like it?
Well, I don't suppose that I liked the idea. I was never much good at formal games. I was not a footballer. And it seemed to me that you had to be... Drill was very much a team, all doing things at the same time together. But in the end, it was quite interesting that you could polish up your techniques, and you could be as good as the next one and slightly better if you had to. And there was a certain satisfaction in marching or being in a body of people all going the same direction. There was camaraderie. I think it encouraged camaraderie drill, funny enough.
And what else might you be doing in the morning session?
Well, it was nearly all of it. A bit of square bashing, but most of it was in navigation, seamanship, all the things that a young naval officer had to learn, the dozen different branches.
So
gunnery, torpedoes, you know.
Well, let's run through some of them.
I can't, it's a long time ago.
You don't remember the sort of things you learned?
No.
How did you find it? I mean, were you interested in the subject?
I was very interested in it, and it was extended, because it went on through the dog watches. The dog watches, we'd be working until 6 o'clock and sometimes until 8 o'clock in the evening, because there was a war on, just started, and they were very, very anxious to get us out as quickly as we could, and we were given no spare time. Not quite true. We had Saturday afternoon and Sundays off.
And what about, I mean, some things you might remember is being made to go over this mast. The masthead.
Well, I do remember, and it wasn't so much being made to, but you it was looked upon to be a good idea if you did. There was no compulsion to it. And I cheated. I went through the lover's hatch, which is the hole in the middle, not round the shrouds on the outside. And it was fairly scary, because when you go up a rope, up the rope ladder, as it were, it's giving all the time. There's nothing solid about it, so you're swaying all the time. And you look down, and there's a net down below, and you're a long, long way up. And it's a big mast. But once you've done it, you get a certain satisfaction that you've done it. And then you realise that there are young boys there who would race up these things, go around the outside and go right up the topmast and stand on the cap. Button boy. And you thought, well, not me, no. But you talk to a certain amount of humility, I think. Cut you down the size a bit.
So you demonstrated a reasonable amount of courage, but you weren't prepared to go too far.
Well, as much as I had to. But when we had time off, There was a Lieutenant Commander Anger, I do remember. He was supposed to have been retired from the service and become a vicar and had come back as a Lieutenant Commander and with particular interest in training up young seamen. And he used to take us out sailing in Portsmouth Harbour in a cutter. And that was, to me, that was great, because suddenly, within a week or two of arriving there, there I was sailing in a naval cutter with about 8 or 9 other people. And that was quite exciting. Never, ever sailed before. Not the sort of thing that one did as a young man. Yachting was for not for middle-class people at all.
And you took to it?
Oh, I loved it, yeah.
What about the air? You were there as a naval airman. This seems very naval-oriented, except for the aerial navigation. Did you actually do anything towards the air other than the aerial navigation?
We never flew. We learnt about the different types of aircraft and their functions. There were the swordfish and the walrus, I remember particularly. And the walrus had a top speed of 18 knots. And it was quite fun because the propeller was behind you and you just looked out in front. And but basically we didn't have any contact. We didn't even see an aircraft. But this all went on for about until about December. And I was called up in front of the divisional officer who said, "We've got problems with you." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, one, we think your eyesight isn't perhaps quite up to it. No, we've noticed that. But the second is, we've had a note that you were a student, you're going to university to study chemistry, and you're a reserved occupation. Now, we don't quite know what to do with you, but they gave me an eye test, and they said you're not quite sharp enough for an observer. You had to be top. And I had been wearing glasses at school, and I'd dropped them then. But it was possibly the effect of the blackouts and so on. Maybe, we don't know. Anyway, they sent me on leave, indefinite leave, and said it wasn't likely I'd be coming back in the Vietnam, and there wasn't much point in a chap like me going over to become an ordinary seaman in naval service. So I might consider going back to university. So I did. Didn't want to. And I spent 4 months at Imperial College in Bell Bottoms, drawing naval pay and drawing naval rations.
This is Imperial College?
In Royal College of Science in South Kensington. And I joined there in the middle of the second year of a 3-year course. And there was a war going on all around me, and I didn't enjoy that very much, and I was there. And
so this was December 39 you went there?
Yeah. Which was a great letdown, because that's where I didn't want to go. I wanted to be at sea. And so I was at Imperial College, and when there was Dunkirk and all the rest of it, it was traumatic for me. So
Did you find you could cope with your science studies, or was your mind just elsewhere?
Well, up to a point I coped, but I did arrive halfway through the first term, so I had a bit of a struggle. But we got there, and I do remember a fire watch. I was living up in North Kensington and going round in the evenings with a tin hat and a stirrup pump, putting out incendiaries when they came over, which was a bit interesting. I tried to get one as a souvenir, but they all were, the ones I'd hidden away that hadn't exploded, that somebody else always found first. I couldn't hang on to one.
What was the method of putting out an incendiary? If you go through it.
Well, the beginning of it was you got a stirrup pump and a bucket of water. You carried the water up towards the incendiary, then you'd use the stirrup pump on it. That was the theory. But then that theory failed a bit after a time because they started putting little bombs inside the incendiary. So you decided that what you do, you wait till it be finished first and then you go and try and put the fire out afterwards. Well, most of the time you're looking around for reporting incidents. I think there's only about two fires they ever attempted to put out. An attempt is the word, because it really was just something to keep people from getting who wanted to do something, give them something to occupy their minds. But we lived in a brick-built surface shelter. We went in there when it got dark, and we spent the night there on wooden slatted bunks, and occasionally go over to the house to make a sort of pot of tea and bring it back. I remember coming back on one occasion, walking out the front door across the shelter, across the road, and there was a noise like a load of flower pots being dropped off a balcony. And there they all were, all the incendiaries are dropping all around me as I was walking across. And that, we were in the middle of a stick of bombs, and, you know, it was a fairly hairy business in London then. And in the morning I cycled down to Imperial College, and all you ever heard was the sound of people sweeping up broken glass. Remember that, still remember that. But when I got to my final examinations, I was getting more and more disenchanted, because I was told, when you get your degree, we've got a job waiting for you. And I said, oh yes, two things. One, am I going to get a degree? They said, unless you're absolutely bloody stupid, this year you will get your degree.
And when was this? Sorry,
1941, in June. And I said, what sort of job? They said, well, you've got a choice, really. You can go down that, join the research team down below. We're quite happy to have you. They're researching into nerve gases. And I said, oh, yes. And, or you can go up to an ammunition factory up in Scotland. They want a shift chemist up there. And I said, well, I want to go back to sea. And they said, well, I'm not going to do that. I can tell you that. So I thought, this is a bit of a challenge, really. So during my final examinations, that were partly written and partly in the lab, there were 2 days organic practical. And the first day I organised so that I had a gallon of beer put in the ice chest with my name on it, which I consumed. And I got thoroughly pissed. When I offered a glass or beaker to the invigilator, a terribly nice man, Dr. Conn, he said, no, he didn't think he should, really. And, by the way, what are you doing tomorrow, he says to me. And I said, well, I'm back here, I suppose. He said, I'd take the day off of you. There's no point in your coming back tomorrow. And I was the only person who didn't get through. And they said to me, look, we understand you started late and so on. You can do the final year again if you would like to. And I said, no, thank you. They said, well, that means you've got to go and be called up. And I said, yes, please. They said, you must be mad. And I said, no. So I got called up. And I went into the... I had about 2 months before I went up to North Wales, to Puthilly.
And that would be around about August then?
Yes.
41.
Well, no, wait a minute, it'd be later than that. No, but about September. About September.
1941.
41. And that was up to Puthilly, which was a Butlin's holiday camp, taken over as HMS Glendower. And I went up there as a very ordinary seaman, equal, very equal to everybody. And then we did have a mixture, right across the spectrum. And I learned you learn to cope. And I had a big advantage that I knew the naval routine. I could put on my uniform, and I became a class leader with no time at all. So I had my HMS St. Vincent cap tally, which I wore with some pride. And I was making quite sure that people noticed me. I wanted not to stay as a rating. I wanted to become an officer, because that was where the interesting jobs were, I thought, and I think I was right. So I became a class leader, and then I became, while I was still at Glendower, a CW candidate.
CW?
Well, CW is interesting. They didn't tell us what it meant, but in fact it should have been WC, wardroom candidate, but they couldn't call us WC candidates for the obvious reason, so they called us CW candidates. But we weren't told that at the time. That was a secret. Anyway, from there,